right. Hey, everyone. This is Jerry Fabianic on KYGTLPFM 102.7 and 103.9 on the air. And this is The Rabbit Hole. And, you know, hope you enjoyed that first hour talking here with Stephen Craig, Cheryl Carpinello, and Catherine Spader about the epic hero and the hero's journey. And we're going to be talking more about that in a way here, because in the studio right now with me is Tim Hall, and his new book out called Marines Never Cry, Becoming a Man When You Needed To, or When It Was...
When It Mattered.
When It Mattered. Okay. Mm-hmm. Welcome, Tim. And again, I want to, you know, I brought the last hour to you here, sponsor. I want to thank all our sponsors. This next hour is brought to you by Dex. So if you have any needs for information, you can go to 1-800-CALL-DEX, 1-800-CALL-DEX, or dexknows.com to get, you know, some information out there if you need to get in contact with someone there, too. So, welcome, and we're running a few minutes late here behind, but let's have a good conversation. Wow, what a book. What a great work.
Well, thank you, Jerry. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And by the way, we have some local people. Bob Brown called in here earlier to say that he was going to be listening, and he is listening here. So
Bob Brown, our Oldsmobile Club guy.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes, sir.
He's listening here. So, Bob, thank you for tuning in, and hopefully we have more. I'd you know, passed a word on through Troy Erickson about you coming in. Let's talk about your work. Where did it come from? You know, why? You know, what is it?
Well, I have a book of little short stories. It began in 1958. So I kept the darn thing. So I've always been tinkering around with writing stories, and had some good influences in my life that kind of encouraged that. And in the last few years, I belong to a group called Cooper's Troopers. These are Marines from all of the battles, the major battles of Vietnam, World War II, Korea, Afghanistan, Iraq, about 120 of us. Some of these guys are writers, and they've done a very good job. And I was just watching them work and read their stories, and I thought, this is amazing. I guess I could do that too. So I finally got around to it. I retired, and I thought, this is a lot of things came together at the same time. So I thought I'd give it a shot. And of course, it was a you know, a million page book at the beginning, and I had a lot of help having people look this over and kind of cut it down a bit and stay focused. But it's just wanted to tell the story. And I'll tell you, Jerry, there's another thing that motivated me, and it also came out of this Cooper's Troopers group. There's a tendency, it seems to me, to not give credit. I might say that, to not, in some cases, in some cases it gets to be not show respect for people who were non-infantry, people who were by at random selected to be infantry.
Yeah.
You know, they carried the brunt. They suffered and died, and it's a rough, tough job. But there's a lot of guys behind them and with them that have different occupational specialties, but were there too, and also sacrificed and deserved a lot of credit, in my opinion. So what I wanted to do here also was, I was a truck driver, and I wanted to write a little bit about what truck drivers did in Vietnam. And this applies to the Marine Corps, applies to every branch of the service. So it's dedicated to the truck drivers of Vietnam, the unsung heroes, as I call it. But, you know, so it was just to show another side. And there's some shooting and some of the typical stuff, but it's not a shoot 'em up, as they call it. This is a story of how it begins.
Right.
About this guy, Zeke, and how he grew up northeastern Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And how he moved on, and what kind of motivated him to join the Marine Corps, what it was like at Parris Island, seriously, what it was really like, and then the training that went on afterwards, and all the little pieces that fit, and then finally arriving in Vietnam. And as a naive, despite the training, a naive 19-year-old, who was had a different idea of what the war was going to be about.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of grew up in the World War II era, our fathers and so on and so forth. We took gained our perceptions about war and those kinds of things from an earlier generation. So we're there, and it's very different. So I wanted to describe some of that. Mm-hmm. And not a feel sorry for me book, not a, oh gosh, woe is me. It's just the facts. And the feedback I've gotten so far is, that's what it was like. I've gotten a lot of feedback from people who were there in some of the same places I was, in an infantry capacity too, and do appreciate that. And say, yeah, as rough as it is, it is a little rough to read, but it was what it was.
Yeah, and it's not only for all you folks that were in the war. I had brothers that served over there. But what I found, it took me back into that era in that time. I was growing up. I graduated from high school, for example, in 1968. Mm-hmm. And I was caught up in the draft sort of thing there. And so those of us that were in that realm, in that era, that faced it, you know, mm-hmm. that potential of going off to Vietnam, having your life uprooted. That's why I tell young people that were born post-1955, you kind of have it easy there. You didn't have the Damocles sword hanging over your head. Mm-hmm. Now, your character, Zeke, volunteers.
Absolutely. There was a draft, and for a lot of people, it was an upheaval for them. They didn't want to go. They didn't want to be there, and they sure as heck didn't want to be drafted into the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
Because the Marine Corps started the draft after I got finished with basic training. The next group in was going to be some draftees, which they did not care for. They did not like the idea of people having to be forced to be in their Marine Corps. And so there was kind of a distinction back then between draftees and those who volunteered. But maybe we were the nutty ones. We stood up and said, yeah, take me. But we saw it as a challenge, too. You know, when you're 18 years old, there's so much else. You know, war, it's such an abstraction. You know, part of it is, can I do this? I want to test my mettle. I think you don't really say that to yourself literally, but you think you're a tough guy. You think you can do this. And you want to be a part of something bigger. So you, yeah, I can do this. Yeah, sure. I'll be different. I'll show
myself. And that's what was interesting. You know, we were talking in our last hour here about the call to adventure in here. And so he goes like, yeah, okay, so there's this war. So what was that element within Zeke? Because I'll be, you know, as I'm reading this, I was intrigued by the character mm-hmm. because he's one that I saw as kind of like an anti-hero. He follows the hero's path, but he doesn't do it in this very high-minded, noble all the way, you know, process there, you know, as he goes through. And yet he does have these very high moral standards. I mean, he there's something that, you know, especially in the scenes, you know, towards the end when he comes back home. And when he's in Vietnam, he's, you know, and he sees this stuff going on. He goes, are you kidding me, sort of stuff.
Well, I'm so glad that came out to you, to the reader. That's exactly right. You know, some of it's you're 18, okay? So you go in at 18. You think you're bulletproof. So that explains, mm-hmm. I probably should have said that previously. There's a sense that it won't happen to you.
Right.
You know, they used to say in training, look to the man to the left.
Right.
Look to the man on the right. Within 6 months, one of you will be dead. And they weren't kidding.
Mm-hmm.
So we would kid about it, though. We would kid. I'd look to the guy to the right and say, well, that's got to be you, not me. And we'd laugh like fools. And so there's a sense that it won't happen to you. Mm-hmm. So that's the other thing, that you'll get through this. And it'll be an extraordinary adventure. And you'll come back and you'll be able to tell all kinds of, you know, it's just a kind of crazy mindset. But you do go over. The training was very good. It was very... There was a sense that we were going there for a good reason, particularly 1966, out of basic in 65. There was a sense that this was the right thing to do. We were supposed to be helping the Vietnamese.
A noble purpose.
Yeah, it was. And mm-hmm. man, communism, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. So you go there and you find that, very different than what you thought. You weren't able to really identify the enemy. They could be the guy next to you. They could be the person that's cleaning up over here. So then it becomes, for some people, all Vietnamese are enemy.
Yeah.
And I couldn't quite buy that. And then some of the things that went on, some of the hostility toward the Vietnamese and South Vietnamese that we're supposed to be helping, was very disturbing. Okay, now, we're Marines are rough and tough and all that. We'll go after the enemy. But you just don't... You got to know who the enemy is before you take control and do some things you shouldn't do.
Yeah, and it looked as if that prior to going over there, what I saw Zeke was to one who saw the world in very clear, stark, black and white terms. Mm-hmm. There's
yes.
good and evil.
Very good.
We're the good guys. There's bad guys
Absolutely.
Over there. But then when he got over there, he started to see that the the so-called enemy, you didn't know who was the enemy, who was your friend. And so that made some of his fellow soldiers, whoever, compatriots, very caustic about it. And they all became that. And yet he still had this high moral standard and said, no, they're not all the enemy.
We tried. There was some – I delineated some – an interaction I had with a guy when I first came there. And he was an old salty Marine and told me some things. And finally I ended up smacking him, knocked a sandbag in his face.
Yeah.
Because it got to be – you know, he got to be a little bit over – anyway, one thing led to another. I'll just let the readers check that out.
Spoiler alert here.
Yeah, spoiler alert. No, well, there was a good reason for it. I didn't – it was barbaric, the things he was telling me. I just got there, and this guy's telling me some crazy stuff, and we got into an argument, and that's how I settled that one. But, you know, there's several events in here that would, I think, show exactly our connection to the Vietnamese people. It opened my eyes. Let's just say Zeke. Opened Zeke's eyes. The refugee camp... I talked about that. I have a little section there about Vietnamese cry too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When the refugee, the war is going on all over Vietnam, South Vietnam, and they had to be uprooted and come into the, closer to the urban areas and live in refugee camps. Well, at one of the refugee camps nearby where I was, where Zeke was, got on fire. Mm-hmm. And Zeke and his fellow Marines had to help put that out. And Zeke saw a guy he knew who had worked on the base crying, just rolling in the sand and crying like you have never seen such emotion, ever. Why? It was because his two little boys lying nearby were caught up in the fire, mm-hmm. and they were dead. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a pretty sight, and I described that. And I found out that his wife had died, too. So I held him. I didn't know what else to do. I kind of tried to speak a little French. I took a little French in high school, you know, so I'm trying to speak something to him, a little pidgin Vietnamese. And he just grabbed a hold of me, and I grabbed a hold of him and tried to comfort him. But by golly, you know, what an experience. It's like your previous guests were talking about. You have to sometimes experience some of the really bad things, and there's something good, positive that comes out of that. It's quite a thing to have to go through that, but something did. I just saw the whole war and these people in a whole different light. Anyway, enough of that one.
Well, you know, and there's a profound, and I'd like, you know, encourage you to, you know, you got that one story in there about Dot.
Yeah, that's really part two of it, too. The children, and I think everybody who was in Vietnam has had a soft spot in their heart for the kids. Mm-hmm. They also did some damage. They could kill you, and they could put a hand grenade in your truck, in that gas tank, with a little piece of tape around it with the pin pulled, and when that gasoline disintegrated that tape, it would blow the living daylights out of everything in sight. So there were some kids that were forced to do that, encouraged to do that, but mostly not. Mostly these were just wonderful kids who wanted some food, wanted to be friends, just loved the attention. I have a section in here where I described when we were out on the bunkers guarding our perimeter, where the kids came up every night, you know, just before dark. And they had to leave because it was a free fire zone. But they came up and got the chop-chop, they called it, you know, a little sea rations and some of the care packages, which was food from home and so on. So he'd come on, give them some stuff, and we'd go back and forth. And I got some great pictures. There's a little girl named Dot. She was the most beautiful little kid. Gosh, I have pictures, and originally I was going to put her picture in here. Anyway, they'd come up there. It was like my kids. I had pictures taken with these kids. You know, it was just wonderful. Wonderful. So I decided to write a little bit. I have just a couple pages here, and I'll read this through. And it says, "Goodbye, little Dot. During the day, it was relatively peaceful along the bunker lines, except for occasional sniper fire. From somewhere way out in the dark hills covered with trees and vegetation to the north or west, occasionally a bullet would hit its mark and do some damage, but few Marines were killed. At dusk, when Zeke and the bunker Marines showed up to assume their positions at the perimeter, a group of kids would greet them just outside the concertina wire, waving and begging for chop-chop, a term they use for food. The kids spoke pidgin English. They were charming, cute, and usually well-mannered. Zeke always had something from his sea rations box to give them. He sometimes pulled pokey bait. Now, that's a Marine Corps term. It just means candy, gum, stuff you get from home, maybe, out of his care package from home. He did not know about operant conditioning theory at the time, but he was applying it every day by using food to shape and reward begging behavior. The youngest of the bunch was a cute little girl. She was shy at first and wouldn't reveal her name. The other kids chimed in and told Zeke that her name was Dot. It was something else in Vietnamese, but it sounded like Dot. That was close enough. She was adorable. When they saw her picture, Zeke's three little sisters wrote back from home asking him to bring her home with him when he got out of Vietnam. They were serious. Every evening at the same time, the kids stood in front of Zeke's bunker on the outside of the wire, waving and calling to him with delight. Zeke would wave back, banter with him, hand out food to each one. As the sun went down, the kids knew they had to DD, that means leave, because they were in a free fire zone. Anything moving after dark was fair game. Things broke down when one of the boys decided to sneak into Zeke's bunker during the day, when it was generally unoccupied, to help himself to an extra ration of chop-chop. The kid snaked his way through the concertina wire. Unbelievable. There were rows and rows of this concertina wire. It was unbelievable. But this little, I could see his footprints. He just withered and wound his way around and got through the concertina wire, got into the bunker, got into the food, and it was all unnecessary. All the kid had to do was show up as usual, and he would have gotten his share. Instead, he got greedy and risked losing his life. Now, Zeke stormed out through the gate, gathered all the kids in a school circle, which is just collecting together. It's a military term we used, and raised holy hell with them. Had the tower guard spotted them, their little bodies would have been shredded. Marines manning the corner towers were under strict orders to open fire with their 50 calibers on anything and anybody that attempted to breach the wire at any time, day or night, no exceptions. Zeke told the kids that they were little thieves, and stealing from his bunker was number 10, which was very bad, very bad, especially after he had been so kind to them. More worrisome was how anyone could sneak through the concertina and enter a bunker sight unseen. If a kid could do it, then so could VC. That is the Viet Cong, that is the enemy. Zeke wanted to know which boy was the thief and insisted they fess up. A boy named Tan raised his hand timidly. Tears were forming in his eyes. Zeke took a picture of him and threatened to send it to and send it to the QC, which is the, that's the police, essentially, and to discourage any of that stuff in the future. Tan promised to be good. Blubbering through a stream of tears, he seemed more upset about losing Zeke's friendship than anything else. Zeke hugged Tan, and others gathered around for some hugging as well, especially Dot. She was very upset about the whole affair and had tears running down her cheek. Zeke wiped her face and gave her a kiss on the forehead. See, Marines aren't so tough after all, you know? Anyway, having made his point with the kids, Zeke was about to hand out ham and lima beans, the sea rations he had squirreled away in the bunker, when a Vietnamese man beamed up behind him. He was wearing what looked like a black bamboo vest over a black shirt, black shorts, and the customary coolie hat. He looked like a VC poster boy. His presence was out of nowhere, startled Zeke. Marines never let anyone sneak up on you under any circumstances. The enemy should never catch you by surprise. It could cost you your life. That had been a constant refrain in boot camp and in other training. Zeke had been so preoccupied with the kids that the man had slipped up behind him undetected. Dung Lai, which means stop yelled Zeke, signaling him to stop as he slipped his rifle off the shoulder and flipped it to the ready position in a quick circular motion. Practiced Marines could perform the slip and flip maneuver in less than a second. The man stopped short and looked terrified. "You give me chop chop?" The man held his hand out, palm up. His face was weathered and his smile revealed a gold tooth sparkling in the sun. At the same moment, Dot yelled, "Cha, Daddy," and ran toward the man with a big smile on her face. A 50 caliber round from the nearby corner tower struck the man squarely in the chest. The sound of the impact was extraordinary, as was the result. The bullet went straight through him and came out his back, leaving the hole the size of a softball. There was blood and tissue all over Zeke and the kids. The man was knocked flat. The white sand was red as he bled out. The kids started crying and screaming uncontrollably. Zeke threw himself on Dot to protect her, but it was too late. The big 50 caliber bullet that tore through the man's body had hit Dot in the throat, nearly decapitating her. Both Cha, Daddy, and Dot were dead before they fell to the ground. Zeke and the other guards nearby had hit the deck with rifles at the ready. And I won't, there were some expletives here that I won't say on the radio. For a second, Zeke aimed his M14 at the guard and wanted to shoot him. Someone yelled loudly, "Cease fire," several times. Zeke threw down his rifle and picked up Dot's lifeless body, her blood dripping over his hands, onto his clothes and his boots. He couldn't believe what had just happened right before his eyes. Zeke laid Dot's little body on the sand and vomited as a gaggle of officers and enlisted men rapidly converged on the scene. Zeke was in shock. He couldn't stand or walk. He just sat down next to her, expressionless. He couldn't talk or hear what anyone was saying to him. His ears were ringing. He felt like going absolutely crazy, but didn't. It was as if he had a built-in circuit breaker that automatically tripped to prevent overloads and protect him from melting down. The tower guide had seen the VC-looking man approach and became suspicious, so he watched him through his binoculars. He mistook the shovel strapped to the guy's back, and when he saw Zeke flip the rifle, as if to defend himself, he let him up, as the expression went. As it turned out, the man was not an enemy soldier. He just looked like one, just Dot's daddy. The guard was held harmless. Killing is not murder in a war zone. If there's a clear and present danger, he was just doing his job, it was said. Even though it was broad daylight and there were other Marines and kids in the line of fire, Dot was considered collateral damage. Our little Dot was considered collateral damage. I wouldn't be coming home with Zeke. Her family was compensated for her death and the death of her father by the U.S. government, and the incident was closed. The kids took off, never to return, their hearts and minds lost to America forever.
Wow. When I read that, obviously, and I can tell by the emotion, you know, that you're displaying here, what a powerful experience that was for all involved. And just as hearing as a third person, you know, or as a third party, you know, the reality of war. It also got for me, Tim, with that phrase in there, it was like a circuit breaker mm-hmm. that flipped. Mm-hmm. That when I looked at this young man, who was kind of cocky and so forth when he leaves Scranton, PA, and heads off to war, and is disappointed after Paris Island that he can't go directly to Vietnam, that there's a lot more to learn here. And I don't know, and get your feedback on this or your interpretation, but to me, that circuit breaker did not flip. He was able to hide it and repress it, but at that point, because what I saw in here was this very human relationship that this young soldier had with these little children. He was like the uncle, the big brother.
That's right.
It was very personal. Mm-hmm. And they loved him, and he loved them back. And when that starts to come into play, all this, you know, out there, you know, the macho stuff, we went there and kick butt and everything, just goes out the window because they're little children. And to read that scene in that way, and when she said daddy, meaning the man out there, but in a way, Zeke was kind of like daddy too here. And I mean, this to me was good riveting one. When I read it.
Good one. You got it. That's exactly how we felt about these kids. And we did see them as the reason we were there. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to be there to help. And they were just a good symbol for us. You know, why did we get involved in this in the first place? It was for them. And it turned out to be correct. I mean, it was pretty brutal once we left and what happened to these kids. And it would be interesting to know what happened to them. Yeah. I'm not optimistic. You know, they were probably caught right in the middle of everything.
Yeah.
So there were other things, you know, the refugee thing. And we could distinguish. I mean, we really could. You know, when it comes to dealing with the bad guys, there's no slack. No more slack than they gave us. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these are human beings. They're real people. We're there to help. And I am not alone in this feeling. Our Vietnam veterans feel this way, especially now. In hindsight, you look back and you go, yeah. And if we had, if, you know, there's a lot of ifs, we could have done a little bit better job and we could have done it quicker. And,
you know, on that, but if we go back to what we were talking about in the first half of my show, and you were sitting here listening to, you know, the others, you know, fellow authors, mm-hmm. also tell, because it, to me, the connection is the story of that hero, that person that goes off to have experiences that none other can have. Okay.
That's right.
I mean, how many Americans, we had the draft and everything, but even if you look at Afghanistan and Iraq today, how many Americans are actually caught up literally in the war itself, you know, or even their families? It's a very, very small, mm-hmm. tiny percentage, mm-hmm. 1%, whatever.
That's right.
And so the rest of us are just like in the Greek tragedy. We're in the audience. We're observing and seeing what's going on out there. And to me, there was an incredible learning curve for Zeke. It doesn't seem, if you just read on the surface of the story, that he's kind of like the same guy at the end, but he's not. He's very different because he is not only battle-scarred, hardened, everything, but he has now this other side of, because he has not only faced tragedy and war, okay, and I'm going to read a piece right here that's also struck me, and but also on the home front, again, we won't ruin it for the readers, mm-hmm. to say, okay, what is that? But this scene here, this almost towards the end of the chapter here, and I think it was about the bloody red sneakers. And mm-hmm. this happened right after there was an attack and a lot of his buddies are killed.
Mm-hmm.
That one to the left, the one to the right, and maybe both, and the one in front of you too, were dead.
It was all of them.
And he gets the news. And I'll skip all the description ahead, but he says, try as he may, he could not shake the image of the bloody red sneakers Wilbur described. He tried to make himself laugh or redirect his thoughts to something formal or normal and mundane. It just did not work. He felt his tears running down his face, which he thought was odd since he wasn't crying. And your title is Marines Don't Cry. But he was. Mm-hmm. He suddenly hit his steering wheel and dashboard with such force that he cracked them both and thought he had broken his hand. The knuckles were bleeding and his left hand was numb. No feeling at all. His outburst ended as suddenly as it began. He crossed his arms, closed his eyes. He was exhausted. After an hour or so, he opened his eyes, blinked a few times, and rolled down the window to smell the fresh air. Then he remembered Wilbur's bad news. He yelled out to the world as loud as he could, "Hey, everybody, all my friends are dead. They died for God, country, and Corps, and none of you bastards give a shit. I could use some help here." But no help came.
Oh, man. Hmm.
A couple of people in the park looked at Zeke, sitting in his Le Sabre, hurried off thinking he must be drunk or crazy. He could not blame them. He was on his own, and he knew it. Nobody cared. Zeke always discounted his own emotions by reminding himself that compared to those suffering around the world at any given moment, his pain was insignificant.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. What if you hit one of those landmines and got your legs blown off? Then you would have something to piss and moan about. Get a grip, boy. All the Marines in Hooch 240 were enlistees. They knew and accepted what they were getting into. Would they cry for you? Stop having this effing dramatic moment here. He wanted to use the phrase commonly used in Vietnam, don't mean nothing, but he could not force it out. The deaths of his friends, more than something, was everything.
Oh. Who wrote that? Jeez, Jerry, that... Oh, I gotta. Yes, that was how it was.
It was
for Zeke. I mean, it is a fiction book. It's I want to try to. It's based on reality, though. I think those experiences, those thoughts, those feelings, those emotions, were felt in one way or another by everyone who was in Vietnam.
Absolutely.
Some more than others. You know, it's. Mm-hmm. Some things were just annoyances. Other things were serious problems. And death being the ultimate.
Yeah. We're going to take a little bit of a music interlude here. I have this song by Billy Joel about Vietnam. I'm going to play a little bit of part of that there. So let's see what we got, if I got this queued up correctly here. Oh, maybe not. Okay. Oh, here we go. Does that sound familiar?
I know the song.
And the choppers.
To shoot the landscape, we pass.
right. Hey, everyone. This is Jerry Fabiano, KYGT LP FM 102.7 and 103.9 on the air here. This is a rabbit hole visiting here with Tim Hall, who is the author of the work we're discussing here, Marines Never Cry. Very powerful time emotionally, Tim, when we were off mic here a little bit, you had brought up something that to me was completely insignificant. It's meaningless, but for you it is. And we should talk about that a little bit. I think that's okay. About the 240.
Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah. That is a very interesting number that keeps coming up in my life. I lived at 240 in Long Island. That was our address, 240. We didn't call it anything other than 240. It's such a dump. But we just, you know, it was our home. You know, we were okay. Mm-hmm. But it then continued to emerge. In Vietnam, I was going to Vietnam. I'm going to be back up even further. On the plane to Camp Pendleton to go through jungle warfare training, it was Flight 240. Then I'm in Unit 240, Staging Battalion, at Camp Pendleton for jungle warfare training and things like that. I get over in Vietnam, and the Hooch, the place where we sleep, that's called the number 240. And it just kept coming up. So it's just an interesting little sideline. It seemed to be everywhere. It was a good luck number. I've tried to use it for the lottery, but it's not helping.
Would have been interesting if it were part of the title as well. Because you know.
And I come here. I come here to speak.
Oh, yeah.
And I get off it. Exit 240.
Yeah,
you know,
Idaho Springs.
There's something here.
Yeah, no, and this number keeps coming up for whatever reason, but it ties your story together. The way I look at it.
Yeah, it's people have asked about. It seems like post traumatic stress, and it was called disorder at one point. Now it's post traumatic stress. It seems like there's a sense among perhaps the civilian population or people who haven't been in these situations that we're all supposed to have that. Some people, and we all talk about this, so it's very, I'm just being very candid and straight about it. We talk about, there were some people that were just half whack before they even joined the service, and they just made them more wacky. So you have that percentage, but you had a lot of other people who experienced horrible, horrible things, and nothing, it was just too painful, and it took its toll in many ways, and it's still doing it. You can see the results with suicides and so on that come out of Iraq and Afghanistan and our wars over there now. So, I've tried to downplay that, and because I think, you know, I sort of downplay my experience in Vietnam, that compared to others, nothing. I don't have post-traumatic stress. What I've got is 240 derangement syndrome. That's what I call it. Mm-hmm, because the number reminds me of all this stuff. And I try to make light of it. But I think that I probably didn't have post-traumatic stress for a couple of really good reasons. One is that maybe I'll just narrow it down to this. I'd like to think that myself and many, many others mentally, we could just turn it off. We could handle it, you know, although I don't know. That's kind of a weak one there. I think the bigger issue is that having some support, and I'm going to tie that to what's going on today. If you have someone in your life that can help you talk this stuff through, show a lot of patience, extreme patience and tolerance for what might be aberrant behaviors when you come home, just a little out of the norm, not necessarily crazy, just obnoxious, maybe losing your temper too quick, maybe throwing cigarettes on the floor and squishing them out on your parents' nice wooden floor, and just carrying over some of that stuff from the service. But if you have someone to talk to and support you and listen to you, and reinforce and shape you, help shape, reshape in the right direction, makes all the difference in the world. I can't imagine being alone in this situation. There were guys that lost their girls. Some were killed. Some died when they were in Vietnam. Imagine that. And some walked away from their guy. So there was that support gone. Parents died. or they came home where they didn't ever had parents in the first place. There was nobody. So they turned to self-medication. They turned to alcohol. They turned to the rum-dum friends back home, you know. And it leads nowhere. And it ultimately, in some cases, leads to suicide. And I've got to stress that a portion of these, when I sell this book, half this money goes to our Cooper's Troopers group. And I want it really earmarked for post-traumatic stress counseling and things that will really help. Not stuff that has 100% overhead either. I'm talking about good, solid counselors that can help. It could make the difference between life and death, somebody committing. So everybody needs somebody to talk to help deal with this crap when you come back home. And if it's not there in your family, it's got to be there somewhere, or there's no good end to this.
Absolutely. And, when I... Now, I put it my philosophical way, and that journey in the individual goes on, because with particularly in situations, scenarios like this in war, that's the ultimate battlefield right there. We have the battlefield of life. We all live it every day when we're out there. Mm-hmm. But this is real stuff. People die. You know, I go back to that Henry Blake quote in MASH on TV, and he says there's two rules of war. First one, he said young men, but it's young men, young women, die. And rule number two is you can't change rule number one. And and then the carnage, the horrific stuff when your buddy was, the moral dilemmas that you're faced with there. Because it's not such a clean thing. And I think I recall I had a gentleman on who wrote a book. It was back in December. And his was also based on war experience in Vietnam. And... he was describing a scene in which the American was there, and there was a wounded North Vietnamese or Viet Cong, whichever, but he was real close to death, and he was suffering incredibly, you know, and the man was ready to die. You know, he's pointing, like, shoot me now, put me out of my misery. Mm-hmm. And he said that it wasn't easy, but, it was something that soldier could do. And my question to him, and I said, well, what if that was your buddy? What if that was someone else in your corps who was also near death and suffering? Could you have pulled that trigger? Now, we don't know. You know, it's the moral dilemmas that come up there in a heartbeat, just like Zeke did with little Dot. Mm-hmm. It was a harmless little thing. And so when I read this, I just don't see the events, how they unfold. I'm looking at the character himself, the primary right here, the hero, that's Zeke. And what has happened to him since he left Scranton, you know, a little hard, you know, like, hey, I can kick anybody's butt, you know, one of these. Yes. And then there's these little children that melt his heart. Mm-hmm. And then to see that one in particular get blown away right in front of his eyes with her dad and what that impact has. So he is changed, you know, and that scene I read towards the end there, the red sneakers, when he finds out that guy to his left and to the right and maybe the one in front of him are all gone too. And we carry these experiences through life. Now, we can't change those experiences. It's how are we going to deal with these? And you brought up about PTSD, et cetera, and very real, you know, that because that's the story of when people go into these horrific experiences. It's not like Luke Skywalker, anybody else comes out there, hey, you know, and happy ever after, we ride off into the sunset sort of stuff here. No, this is real life. And guess what? When you come back, you go right back into society and live the rest of your life there. What's that like? Yeah.
Jerry, I want to say something about I've been asked about this. Marines never cry. I've had all sorts of comments, you know, well, oh yeah, and you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, we do, and I do. And a police friend of mine said, well, we did. And I said, well, look, first of all, it's a little tongue-in-cheek, okay? And but here's the reality of this. The first time something really bad happened over there to me, and an extraordinary emotion about it, there was no place to go. There was no place to go to be alone. You just don't even think about such a thing. You know, it happened and it just knocked me off my feet. So I thought, and I'm trying to avoid, because, you know, I'm with those Marines and it's like, this is some serious business. What am I going to do, walk out in the bush? You know, I don't think they like me out there. And then we had to do something immediately. We were called into a situation, and there was no opportunity to let it out. So you can't. So you get used to that. And you find that you really lose your focus if you don't figure out some way to put this to the side, in the back of your mind, deal with it in some way, you will really be ineffective. You'll cost your own life and the life of others. You will just destroy yourself physically. I mean, you could just cry. I think someone asked me, why didn't you cry? I said, because if I started crying, I'd never stop. Mm-hmm. I'd never stop. And so you just don't. And it's not like, okay, if you keep all this bottled up, then you become nuts. Not really. You just deal with it. You learn how to deal with it. But sometimes, as you mentioned, it comes out. And there's just no way to stop it.
Yeah.
As I almost did here.
Yeah.
Talking about Dot.
I could see it right there. And, you know, the emotion on your face and in your voice. And I've done that as well on the microphone here and other experiences, you know, reading a piece or something. It's emotional there because it is gripping. And so while the tears might not be rolling down the face just by the fact that the throat is, you know, constricted or whatever. And, you know, and I think, you know, and, you know, what do we take away from this here? You know, certainly this story is going to resonate with those who were in Vietnam, the vets, mm-hmm. right there. You know, mm-hmm. we have our local community right now, and a number of them are probably listening and hopefully, mm-hmm. you know, and so they will read on a certain level. I'm not a Vietnam vet, but I had brothers that were over there. But I was also a witness to all the events there. I was in college at the time, mm-hmm. et cetera. And we can have our points of view on whether the war was a good war, justified, was right, fought, you know, LBJ, Nixon, whatever. Okay, it's all in the past. You can't change that there. But for me, what is the power of the story is the human drama that went on there. And two things that came to mind that I visualized when I read that scene about Dot, that very famous picture of that little girl that was napalmed, that,
you know,
won the Pulitzer Prize, everything.
Oh, yes.
That speaks volumes. The other is, do you ever see the movie The Deer Hunter?
Oh, yes.
Western Pennsylvania. I see you ever want to learn about Western Pennsylvania at that time. That's it right there. And that scene in there, oh, my God, it is so real.
I think that was the first movie. I think that was 1978, and mm-hmm. I think that was the first movie about Vietnam that I can remember. And I went to see it all by myself, and it was quite moving. I mean, I never heard of any of this Russian roulette business, but the background of these guys in, it could have been Scranton, it looked like.
Sure,
Scranton.
It was Pennsylvania, there you go.
All these run down, anyway, no, I love it. Scranton.
Hunting rifles, the whole thing.
Oh yeah. Man, yeah. Drinking like crazy. Mm-hmm. And there were some parts of that that were extraordinarily very emotional. And you know what? I could admit this, right? Yeah, it's just being a wimp. I came home. I called my mother. I said, hey, you know what? I saw this movie. I said, holy crap. So then once again, mm-hmm. she was there and what kind of walked me through that because I was very upset.
Sure.
I'm just being very candid now. And what I'm telling you is what many other people experience themselves. And so I'm just being candid about it. And it was very helpful. And again, What do you do without that? It could be years later. In our group, in our Cooper's Troopers group, we have veterans of Iwo Jima, Guadalcanal. They're still alive. They're in their 90s. Peleliu, all these horrible, the Chosin Reservoir, Korea. They're there. And in their old, I asked a fellow who was on Guadalcanal and Peleliu, so do you think about this much? He said, not at first, but later it came.
Yeah.
Later it came. And you never know. Later, I was very interested and surprised about that. But he had help. He had his wife. He had people to talk to. He wrote a book. And it was very helpful. But imagine not having that. Imagine having, you know, you're still in that same boat. There's nobody around. Counselors, maybe. I don't know. You know, it's nice to have the mom around. There's somebody that you can talk to, that's all.
And now, and with your story, because I think what's happened, and we're going to talk about this a little bit, the power of story. By you putting it out there, and yes, it's a work of fiction, but obviously you've drawn on personal experience and from others, mm-hmm. you know, too. And I've done the same in my novel, where it's not just all about me. What I think we do is to allow, give permission to to everyone else out there, first of all, you remind them you're not alone. Mm-hmm. Okay, yes. With your feelings and everything there. So if you're, you know, and you see something that triggers memories for you, it's the number 240. You see it and bang, these start to flow in there. Not the 238 or not, you know, 900, and it's not a four-leaf clover or anything like that. It's this specific number. Why? Mm-hmm. Well, okay. So we all have these trigger points in there that will, in a heartbeat, put us right back into that. How do we deal with it? And I think the power of story, and you've written it, and with the idea also promote if others want to, you know, write their stories.
That's
too.
Right. You know, I have to give a shout out to my wife on this. She and I've acknowledged it in the book. Her name is Shirley. Mm-hmm. Shirley looked through this, and when I get the drafts back, and they said, "Did this really happen? Are you sure? You want to say this?" Mm-hmm. and on, but a lot of patience and understanding. Sure. That's an example, and helped me make this, and some beta readers that I had from Colorado Independent Publishers Association, such as Karen Douglas and others. But this, you just have to have people help you. And it wasn't just editing. It was talking through it. When they'd read some of this, they go, "Really?
Yeah."
And maybe you could say that a little differently, or... But you've got people who are interested all the way through. You're one of them too, Jerry.
Yeah, and I think that's what's important there, because particularly those of in the older generation, because the Vietnam War was different than any other. Mm-hmm. Okay, World War II was really clear cut, and there it is. Okay, we have the Nazis, Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, whatever. So it's very clear cut. Yes, there's some moral dilemmas there, you know, like the concentration camps are for the Japanese. Mm-hmm. We know about those. They're called internment camps. Okay. The Iraq War, that was fought primarily with volunteers. Mm-hmm. And so forth. Mm-hmm. Vietnam was the first war that was really televised. It was on the air. It wasn't just, like in World War II, you went to the theater and maybe saw a clip that was already processed and documented. No, this is real life right there. Mm-hmm. It's Walter Cronkite there on the ground showing these very vivid scenes there. It was brought into our living room. It's the first war to do that there. The draft, you know, to, you know, pulling it up and the moral dilemmas that all of us young men were there. You know, some were clear cut, you know, like you, like my brother, you know, it's like signed up, went into the Marine Corps, just did it. Okay, went in there. Well, then there's all the others that say, wait a minute. No, wait, I'm being fodder for the war, whatever, too. So, at any rate, we live these experiences there. And I think what your book does also, Tim, you know what I'm saying, about how it resonates for those of you that were primary characters, actors in the physical thing, but all the rest of us, particularly at that alive at that time, you know, so when I'm reading this and that visual image of that little girl is napalmed, the movie, Deer Hunter, Apocalypse Now comes to mind, you know, all these things here. And to understand who we are, where we are, the human condition, you know, and, you know, and I look at young Zeke here and I'm going like, you know, kid, you need to grow up a little bit here, sort of thing here.
Yes.
And yet to just as an observer, you know, as a reader, and to see that character development through there and to say, you're not as tough as you thought you were here, kid. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a good thing, because that mm-hmm. scene there with Dot just there, and then the bloody sneakers at the end there, and he says he felt he was crying. But he didn't know tears were coming down his face. So he was resisting that whole urge. You know, he wanted to control it, repress it, if you will. But totally, he's human, though. And the emotion is still there. It resonates. And it comes out in all of us. And you know what? It's okay. It's all okay to be vulnerable. And I think it's the great stuff here.
Well, you know, I'm going to go back to what your previous guests had talked about, again, some of these negatives that happen, that, yeah, you think you're a tough guy, and what you just said, you think you're a tough guy, and so you come back, and I don't think this is a story spoiler at all, but there were some things that happened while Zeke was away, mm-hmm. and when Zeke came back, he did some things to make to right the situation. You might say He visited some people who had done some bad things, and he got into a little trouble. But, you know, it's just like someone was saying earlier, you have, by that happening, you realize, and everything in Vietnam, well, you know, you have limits. Man's got to know his limitations, as Clint Eastwood said. But it's also, it prevents you from going any further into the abyss. I'll just leave that up in the air right now. Leave that as a teaser.
Absolutely. That's a great teaser there, because you're right, because he brings home, you know, because he has his whole life experiences. Now, he's at the ripe old age of about 21 when he comes home. Okay, now we look at that as, you know, 20. As old people, 20.
Yeah.
Okay, they're kids. Yeah, okay. Well, when you're 20 or 21, you're a man. You're a real adult and everything. Well, boy, you're saying, okay, well, the adventure's just about to begin here, big guy. So, you know, that sort of stuff there. But he does, and that's how he handles those situations. That's also part of his development, too, as a human being. Because those are part of his experience, the post-war, and his view on the Marine Corps.
Oh, yes.
Wow, that was huge.
You know, somebody, a friend of mine who was an officer and served in some of the same places that I talk about in the book, said there's several things you really got right on this. I was hoping I'd have everything right, but you got a couple things right. He said, what I liked about it was you were blunt and actually honest about the way the Marine Corps was from your perspective. Now, not everybody, but I'm just saying that what I described was what it was at that time and that place. And there seemed to be so many constraints, so many rules, so much disrespect for the rank and file Marine. And it was appalling. Now, did I do a few things I shouldn't have? Yeah, me and maybe a million other guys. But it just... I made a couple of points about other staff NCOs and an NCO particularly in there. We would have died for him. Why? He expected us spit and polish. We didn't have spit and polish in Vietnam, but I mean, it was strict. It was Marine Corps stuff, which we can deal with. But he showed respect.
Yes.
He cared what happened to us when we came back off, of a convoy or something. Who got hit? What happened? Da la la. How are you doing? How's your family? You get a letter from home?
Empathy.
Yeah. We die for him.
Absolutely.
See? But others, mm-mm-mm. I describe in here, I know we're probably a little rushed here, but one last piece. We were on a convoy to the very dangerous place, Arizona Territory. It's near Anwa, southwest of Da Nang. And we got... we got attacked by the bad guys, and my truck got whacked. And so an infantry group that was with us and helping us painted a purple heart on my truck. Now, isn't that nice? Right where the bullet holes were.
Nice.
It was nice until we got back. We got back to the motor pool and got in trouble for having... Good Lord, defacing a military vehicle. And
it's like you wearing your combat boots when you got back into the States, too.
Oh, yeah. But that one was an example of...
Right.
Oh, and I guess they were right. See, they were right. I'm sure I was wrong in doing that. But there was a lot of stuff that just... It would have been a lot better, I think. And but anyway, I describe it. It was what it was. Mm-hmm. But there was never a better high than boot camp, and you felt... good, and you felt good about it, and that's what I kind of remember.
You had a sense of belonging. It was family.
Yep.
And that's there. And it really does come down to relationships, human drama, and interconnections, and I think that's what's so powerful in this story for me. And then you mentioned about, well, okay, Zeke, whoever, didn't make a lot of good decisions along the way, but that's part of the journey. We're not Superman, okay?
Indeed.
And we make mistakes, we fall, but we pick ourselves up and we learn from those mistakes, but we have a moral compass about us too, and that's what Zeke had, on what was right and wrong. That didn't change for him. He saw the world in black and white terms before he went there. Here's good guys, bad guys. Well, now that gets blurred there, but his sense of morality, ethics, that did not change in the whole story. It's the same as to me at the end as it was beginning.
And you know where it comes from? Well, I think I have some descriptions in there of growing up on the farm with my grandfather and others, and he wrote me that letter just before he died, and it said, "You got a dirty job to do, but be a man. He underlined that. Now, what does that mean? I mean, it doesn't mean to be macho. It means to have that moral compass that you just mentioned.
Do the right thing.
You got it right. Absolutely correct.
And he does that. Great. Perfect. Thank you. If people want to get this book, how? Where?
Well, online at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. And I am. It's there's a website in progress. It's going to be called tim.honors. It's under construction right now. And what I'm going to do with that is there'll be information about the book and, you know, the usual stuff you see on and I'll blog a few things. But I'm going to try to see if I can, you know, the line I talked about in the book where it says the truckers, the unsung heroes of Vietnam. There's a lot of unsung heroes. And it doesn't have to be war. It's just people doing the right thing and they didn't have to. People doing things for each other. You see it in everyday heroes, but even that, I don't want to use the word heroes so much. It's just so many good people in the world. We hear nothing but bad, and we just, well, good Lord, you can hardly watch the news without getting an ulcer. But there are so many good things that happened. I am connected with the police department. I'm an honorary lieutenant with Denver, and I have a lot of information there. And you hear about something, somebody who inspires others, somebody who does something good. So I want that to be kind of a site, not just for, you know, the Tim Hall story, but somewhere where we can talk about people we know in our lives, past, present, and just do the right thing and just give them a little respect. Right. This is what we all needed.
And if they want to get in touch with you, do you have an email or anything they can get to? Or?
I do. Here it goes, ladies and gentlemen. It is Jetstream. That's a color. Jetstream 638. That's the horsepower of the car. Whoa, what kind of car is that? Never mind. It's true, though.
I love it.
It's a blue Corvette 638. That's a ZR1. So it's Jetstream 638. Now you'll remember at gmail.com.
And that was fun when we talked at one time down at SEPA.
Oh, yeah. Jerry has got the most beautiful, beautiful car. I don't want to call it a Mustang.
It is.
Some people want to. It's more than a Mustang. It's it's a beautiful, beautiful car. And anyway, I appreciate Jerry, and we talk a little bit about our cars and all the good things in life.
Yeah, it was one of those moments there too, you know, because when I got out and you said, I always wondered whose car this was. And I said,
I want to buy it.
Yeah. And that's then we started talking more, obviously, because we're good. In the same group there too. So, Tim, beautiful work. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
That was it's very powerful, you know, for you to come in and particularly doing that reading there. That's huge. And I really recommend, you know, folks, doesn't matter whether you're in Vietnam or not, if you're younger or older, to understand what this was all about there and to begin to appreciate, you know, all of us around here, that the struggles we go through, and look at that character, Zeke, and how, you know, you might not like him at the beginning, you might not like him at the end personally, doesn't matter, but to see what he goes through there in his experiences is so profound. Is just amazing. I think you just do a brilliant job with it.
Well, I'm humbled. Thank you, Jerry, so much for those words. I appreciate it. And thank you for having me.
You bet. All right. And just a reminder, this show is being recorded. First of all, it'll be rebroadcast on Monday. We'll start at 2 o'clock on Monday, right on through. And I don't know if they'll cut me off at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock here because we went a little bit over here on Saturday. But I'll have this up on my website, and Dave will have it up on the radio's website, you know, first of next week. So you'll be able to get it there. So you can come to my website, jerryfabianic.com. And pick it up there. And I'm going to wrap up with one more song here because we did a couple here. You know, we did the one about Vietnam, but I'd like to see this too. And this one is from, I think it's about 1967, 68, the Young Bloods. And it's all.